But I can tell you this, the 2020 election is going to be the most secure election we've ever held. We had 75% auditable paper ballots in 2016. That number is going to be closer to 95% in 2020.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I have another very timely and important guest for you. David Becker is the founder and executive director of the Center for Election Innovation, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that works with election experts from around the country and from both sides of the aisle to build voter trust and confidence, increase voter participation, and improve the efficiency of election administration. David is formerly a lawyer for the Voting Rights Section of the U.S. Department of Justice, also led the Pew Charitable Trust's Elections Program, where he spearheaded the creation of ERIC, which is the Electronic Registration Information Center. He's one of the most knowledgeable people in the U.S. about the mechanics of our elections. We had a very good conversation about his career and how he's working to assure that our election processes work well as why he thinks the term voter suppression is sometimes overused. David is someone who really understands how well we can trust our election systems at a critical time. So first, our sponsor, and then my interview with David Becker and the Center for Election Innovation and Research.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, David. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is David Becker. I'm the executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, which is a nonpartisan nonprofit based in Washington that works with election officials all across the political spectrum and across the country to help improve elections and make them more efficient and accessible and secure. I've been in elections for about 22 years now. This will be my sixth presidential election. I've worked with the Department of Justice and the voting section there for many years in both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, and then worked at the Pew Charitable Trust, where I led their elections team for several years as well before I found my way and started my own nonprofit.
Pretty cool and interesting career. Where did you grow up?
That's probably a whole podcast. I grew up all over the place. I was born in Washington, D.C., but my family moved away shortly thereafter, and I went to elementary school in Wilmington, Delaware, where I formed an unfortunate allegiance to the Philadelphia Phillies, which I carry with me to this day. Then went to high school and junior high school in Denver, Colorado, and eventually made my way to the Bay Area of California for college and law school, and then back to Washington, D.C. when I started my job at the Justice Department.
Berkeley, then, for college and law school?
Yeah, that's right.
What did you study there?
Well, in undergrad, I studiously avoided studying as much as I possibly could for as long as I could, which was not a very good strategy, unfortunately. I majored in history, then ended up back at Berkeley for law school.
Yeah, one doesn't get into Berkeley for law school without studiously doing some studying. I know that.
Well, I took a little bit of a circuitous path. I had had a very good time in undergraduate and did not have great grades, but had very good law school admission scores, and actually went to another law school for my first year and then transferred into Berkeley for my second year after I finished first in my class that first year. So I was very fortunate.
I knew there was more to that story.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the other law school that you were first in your class in for a year?
It was Golden Gate University in San Francisco. I had a very unusual application given my my grades and my LSAT scores. So, but I did learn my lesson about going to class and working hard in school. And I don't know if other law students would agree with me, but I actually found the first year of law school to be exciting and energizing. And I enjoyed it a great deal and was very fortunate to do well and end up at Berkeley.
Well, I just think it's really a lesson that there's so many second chances in life. Like even if you weren't a great student in college, there's lots of ways to get back into a lane you might want to be. And that's why I asked that kind of question. You don't have to be on the straight and narrow all the way. And so many people end up in interesting positions without having done that, even in this small instance.
I think that's exactly right. And I, now being a father myself, I can't wait to pass on some of these lessons to my son. I mean, I didn't realize what a gift I had been given to be able to attend Berkeley as an undergraduate, especially this is back in the 80s when it was ridiculous how cheap it was to attend one of the greatest universities in the world. I think it was just over $700 a semester if you lived in state in California. And I didn't appreciate that opportunity, but Berkeley is somewhat unforgiving. There's many people waiting to get in. I love the school dearly. And I'm very grateful for the fact that they were unforgiving, that they continuously kicked my butt over and over and over again. And that lesson eventually was learned. And I don't know that I would have learned that lesson someplace else. So I will always have a little part of myself back in Berkeley.
Was it harder to do Berkeley Law than Golden Gate Law? Or are they pretty similar?
I mean, law school is what it is. I mean, and some people find it very hard and some people don't. I personally did not find law school to be all that hard in either place. And that was because I loved it. And I think that's the first place I really learned that if you do what you love, you're never working. I'm fortunate to do that now. And I enjoyed my time at both places. Berkeley Law was a particularly great place to be. And I have many, many close friends from both my undergraduate and law school days in Berkeley that are among my closest friends still to this day, even though I'm across the country from many of them.
How did you end up at the Department of Justice and why?
I was working in a law firm in Los Angeles. I was doing entertainment litigation for several years right out of law school. And I remember being in my office late one weeknight, going through boxes of documents as young associates in law firms often did at that time. And now they probably just do it electronically. And thinking to myself, I'm not really enjoying this at all. And then further thinking, if I'm really successful at what I'm doing now, my reward will be to become a partner overseeing other people doing the same things that I'm doing now. There's a joke that goes around law firms that becoming a partner in a law firm is like winning a pie eating contest and the prize is more pie. I just realized that wasn't what I wanted to do. And I didn't want to go through my career without trying to achieve a dream. And so what I was going to do was apply for a job as a trial attorney doing the work that was most important to me, voting rights work in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. And I knew I would apply, and I knew I wouldn't get the job. I knew that there were thousands of applicants for every single job. I thought I was a very qualified applicant, but there were going to be lots of qualified applicants. And I knew I wouldn't get the job, but then that would kind of release me, and I could tell myself, well, you tried. And now I will become a law firm partner or whatever it is that I will do, and I won't have any regrets. And then 6 months later, I found myself driving across country with all my worldly possessions to take a job at the Justice Department, which started me down this path back in 1998
is that's the Monica year, isn't it?
It's before that. It was mid 1998, and I think that scandal hit in the later part of 1998, if I'm not mistaken. But I remember vividly when it did hit.
What was your time at the Department of Justice like? Was it what you wanted it to be?
It was amazing. For the first couple of years, I was learning my way around voting law. I was working with some of the best lawyers I've ever worked with in my life. I had the privilege of working under Attorney General Janet Reno, who's probably the most dedicated public servant I've ever had the privilege of witnessing, let alone working for. Even with the change of administrations and there was a change of philosophy, for several years, it was still a great job, to be perfectly honest. I got to litigate a case that went to the Supreme Court, a case of Georgia versus Ashcroft, which was about the Georgia redistricting plan in the early 2000s, and I was lead counsel on that case. I was in charge of voting rights enforcement in places like Georgia and California. I was present in September of 2000 observing the election in Selma, Alabama, where they elected the first Black mayor in the history of Selma, a city that is two-thirds African-American, finally electing an African-American mayor. And I was there to observe the election and the ballot counting. And it's something I will never forget, being there in the shadow of the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Is that the same case that Alan Lichtman worked on? Because I interviewed him not too long ago.
So this wasn't actually a case. The voting section attorneys often get called to observe elections in various places, particularly when Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was still enforceable in areas of the former Confederacy, where there could be issues. And this was a situation in Selma, Alabama in 2000, where the mayor of Selma, who was the same mayor that had been there in 1965, a white man who was able to still retain power despite the fact that Selma was overwhelmingly majority African-American, was finally challenged by a very viable African-American candidate, a local businessman. It was expected that the election would be extremely close, extremely contested. There might be some concerns of a variety of dirty tricks being played. And we thought we would be in for a late night. Polls closed at 6 p.m. By 6:25 p.m., the incumbent mayor, Joe Smitherman, conceded. And this is before the sun had even set. And I just remember African-American residents of Selma pouring into the streets in peaceful, joyous celebration. I don't know if you or your listeners have ever been to Selma, but the Edmund Pettus Bridge basically feeds right into the main drag of Selma. And so this is all happening in the shadow of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where, of course, Bloody Sunday occurred, leading to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. It was one of the most emotional things I've ever been a part of. I still think about it often to this day.
Yeah, quite moving to hear you tell about it. How do you feel about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act being gutted?
Well, there's a part of me that kind of the legal analyst part of me that says it's an incredibly activist exercise of judicial power to overturn a law that is justified by several parts of the U.S. Constitution, not the least of which being the 14th and 15th Amendments, and that was overwhelmingly passed by Congress. Over 90% of Congress voted for it, and there are literally thousands and thousands of pages of record to support it. That's the legal analyst part of me. The part of me that has worked in civil rights for years and has been in the Deep South and has seen some remaining vestiges of racism and efforts to retain, in some cases, minority power, not minority in terms of race, but minority in terms of smaller numbers, where whites are smaller numbers, retaining power over majority African-American, largely citizens. I'm morally disturbed by it. Section 5 did a ton of good work over many years to protect minority voters all across the country, not just African-Americans, but also Hispanics and others. And that the Department of Justice no longer has that tool to prevent discrimination in the voting process has made it more difficult to protect minority voters from potential discrimination.
Why did you leave the Department of Justice?
I left in 2005. There are some well-documented issues that occurred around then in terms of politicization of the department, particularly the Civil Rights Division. It was getting very difficult for some of us who were working and committed to nonpartisan protection of minority voters to stay there. I should say this case that I worked on, Georgia versus Ashcroft, which I'm very proud of, which I received an award for. This is a case against the Georgia Democrats. Georgia Democrats who were using African-American voters to prop up vulnerable white Democrats in some districts. And the Voting Rights Act says you can't do that, that African-American voters are not just pawns to be used to support white Democrats. It does not protect the rights of blacks to vote for Democrats. It protects the rights of minorities to vote for candidates that they choose to vote for. And I believe that still to this day very deeply. So I'd worked in a very nonpartisan way, suing Democrats and Republicans where it was appropriate, but it was becoming difficult. And the day I left, I was one of five lawyers in the voting section who left around the same day. And there are some well-chronicled incidents of politicization that became difficult at that time.
when you look at the Department of Justice now in that area, what do you see? Do you pay attention?
Oh, I definitely pay attention. I think what we're seeing with the Department of Justice is very disturbing. And it's not just racial or political at this point. It kind of cuts to the core of our democracy. The recent news that just came out from ProPublica and confirmed by the New York Times that the Justice Department, for the first time that I'm aware of in its entire history, has rescinded the rule that it will not do anything publicly or release any investigations if it could have influence on an election. That was a very core rule in everything that we did at the Justice Department around election time. We were not to be an instrument to assist either party or the incumbent party in any kind of election environment. That's been rescinded. And that's the first time that's ever been done. The Bush administration didn't do it. The Obama administration didn't do it. No administration in history has ever done that. And I'm very troubled by that. I mean, I think if you see how the Attorney General politicized the investigation of alleged military voting problems in Pennsylvania recently, where they found a very small number of ballots that had been mishandled. And it was a total accident. It was 9 total ballots. It was discovered. It was solely a state law violation. There were no crimes. There was no one charged to this day. But the DOJ, after only 3 days of investigation, put out a press release, not only fanning the flames that would lead to distrust of the process, but revealing the contents of those ballots, which pierces the secrecy of those ballots for those voters, especially when it's a small number of voters. It's very, very likely that there's a decent number of people who know who those ballots belong to. And that was a simple problem that was fixable. It is being fixed. But instead, the DOJ has politicized it. And sure enough, later that day, the same day that the press release was put out by the Department of Justice, Attorney General Barr briefed the president on this minor, minor state law issue. And the president used it in his campaign that day. To anyone who's worked at the Justice Department, that is incredibly troubling.
When you see those things that you just cited and the president's attack on mail-in balloting, how do you put that all together? What are they up to?
There are several truths in elections. And one of those truths is that the candidate who thinks he's winning never tries to delegitimize the process. The candidate who thinks he or she is winning is quite content with the process. If you hear a candidate criticize the process, attack the process, that candidate knows they are losing. And I think it's a certain desperation. Fortunately, throughout our history, we've had patriots in our institutions of both parties who were willing to stand up and say, no, 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 you're not going to do this. We're lacking that today. When the Department of Justice becomes an arm of the Trump campaign, we've got a problem. And that's what it appears is happening right now. And there are still patriots in the federal government. There are people doing incredibly good work at the FBI, at DHS, and other places to protect our elections right now. But there are, of course, significant concerns.
I mean, one thing that was interesting about Trump was that after he won in 2016, he almost tried to delegitimize in a certain way the election afterwards by saying he lost the popular vote only because of illegals voting and things that weren't true, and started that commission and everything. So he might be an exception to that rule a bit, that he just wants to delegitimize everything.
Well, I think that's possibly true. But of course, this is because he lost the popular vote. Whatever reason he has for doing it, he obviously does not feel that there are things greater than his own ego or his own impulses. No matter which side you're on, whether you're looking at Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Dwight David Eisenhower, or you're looking at Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, Obama, Clinton, all of them knew there were limits. There was something greater than them that should take precedence. And that's one of the things I think we're lacking right now. And then people surrounding someone like the president who are willing to speak truth to power. That's clearly something else that's lacking right now.
It seems to get you fired.
Yeah, I work in a very nonpartisan way. I can't say enough how many Republicans there are out there and Democrats who are working hard to guarantee rights of voters right now, who are working hard to give them choices to vote, who are working hard to make it easy and safe for them to vote. And it's very easy in this environment, if you're a Democrat, to say, I do not trust Republican secretaries of state. And it's just as easy for Republicans to say that about Democratic secretaries of state. What I want to tell you is that's self-defeating. We've got to trust each other. The Russians want us divided. The Russians want us not to participate. There are going to be states where the Democratic candidates win, where there are Republican election officials, and there are going to be states where the Republican candidates win, where there are Democratic election officials. And that's the way it should be.
Yep, makes sense. And I think you're right. What was your time at Pew like?
It's really where I formed a lot of my philosophy that I have today, which is, there is a place for enforcement. There is a place for litigation. But so much can be done quietly behind the scenes by building relationships and finding solutions. That's what I did at Pew. I worked hard with Republicans and Democrats to ask them what they needed. Where were the problems that they saw? In quiet environments that weren't, where the normal partisanship wasn't in existence, I would bring secretaries of state of both parties together in private rooms, and we would have conversations. And it was amazing how much we agreed on. And I think probably the culmination of that was in my early time at Pew, I asked election officials from all over the country at a major event, if we could solve one problem in elections, what would you want to solve? And every single one of them gave me the same answer, voter registration. Voter registration was a challenge. We didn't have enough people on the list, but the lists were also really out of date. People move a lot, and the election officials weren't getting that information, and they didn't want to. That created problems because people weren't getting notice about the elections that were relevant to them. They might move from one state to another, and there would be an old record in a state they used to live in, but they hadn't gotten registered in their new state. And we brought together election officials, technology experts, academics from all over the country, across the political spectrum, and we started discussing this. And that resulted in 2012 in the creation of something that I'm probably most proud of, the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC for short. And people can check it out at ericstates.org. It's a C3, 501c3, that's run by the states themselves, where they share data with each other in a highly secure environment and help identify people who might have moved or died so they can start the process consistent with federal law of correcting that record or updating that record. But they also identify people that are eligible to vote but are not yet registered, and they reach out to them. So this year, for instance, just in the last 2 months, states in ERIC have reached out to 17 million eligible but unregistered citizens and invited them to register. And that's going to lead to millions of new registered voters. And it's been done by government directly. It's been done by red states and blue states. The states that have done the largest amount of it this past year include Texas, with 3.5 million people contacted, Florida, 2.2 million people contacted, Georgia, 1 million people contacted. Those are all Republican secretaries of state. And then you've also got around 700,000 contacted in Michigan under a Democratic secretary of state, and about 2 million contacted in Pennsylvania, also under a Democratic secretary of state. This has been just a quiet revolution in voter registration that's been incredibly constructive. And the fact that there are 30 states now in ERIC, and they range from states as blue as Connecticut, Illinois, and Oregon, to states as red as Alabama, Utah, and South Carolina. That's a real testament to a solution that works for everybody. And I'm very proud to have led the effort to do that. And that was during my time at Pew.
Why are some states not in ERIC?
Well, ERIC's still pretty new. I get that question a lot. We created it as a voluntary organization. And the reason we created it as a voluntary organization was twofold. One, it was very unlikely Congress was going to act to require this kind of thing. But two, it was really important that ERIC actually work, that ERIC actually deliver the benefits to the states that we intended it to. And if it couldn't do that, we didn't think states should be bound to be a part of it. It started in 2012 with 7 states, and it has grown steadily to the point now where 30 states are in, representing about 2/3 of the eligible voter population of the United States. I actually think by 2024, we'll have close to all 50 states in. And if you had told me in 2012 that within 10 to 12 years, we'd have almost all of the states in, I'd say, where do I sign?
There's a couple states that
are more notorious than others for working at voter suppression, Georgia, Wisconsin, different states like that. What's the overlap between states doing that and in and out of ERIC?
So I first of all, I'll pull an old lawyer trick, which is I will reject the premise of your question and answer the question I wish you had asked, which is I actually think voter suppression, we're painting with too broad a brush when we use that term a lot. There's a lot of things that are occurring that are just normal, that are just normal accidents in some cases, and some cases aren't voter suppression at all. But in our hyper-partisan environment, it's easy to label things. States like Georgia are removing far fewer voters than a state like California. California is removing the largest number of voters of any state by far.
Proportionately?
Even proportionally. Georgia did what's called a list maintenance operation in 2019. They flagged for removal around 300,000 registered voter records. And that's only about 3% of their voter registration list in a state where they undoubtedly have about 10% of people who've left based on just census data. And then they published the entire list online and said, if we have any of these names wrong, tell us and we'll fix it. They did this in 2019. It is very, very easy for us to fall back on tropes about partisanship, about voter purges. A voter purge isn't a thing. That term is not used in law. It's not in the National Voter Registration Act. It doesn't exist. Voter list maintenance is a very important thing, and it's as enfranchising as it could be potentially disenfranchising, because it is about updating records for people who have moved in large part. And it's also about communicating to the American voter that the system has integrity. And voter list maintenance can be a really good thing. Just the sheer numbers of people who are removed from lists should not be a concern. It should be a question of, are they the right people? And what steps is the state doing to make sure that they're complying with federal and state law? What steps is the state doing to make sure they're getting the data analysis right on this? Because so that you flag the right records for removal and you don't flag the wrong records for removal. Those are all legitimate questions, and some states do a better job of it than others. But it would be much more helpful. This is an area where I work quite a bit. Be much more helpful if we all turn down the heat on the rhetoric a little bit and actually do some data analysis. There was a recent story in Georgia and Wisconsin about alleged voter purges. First of all, Wisconsin wasn't a purge. No one was removed. It also has same-day registration. And both of these were publicized in their entirety in 2019. That someone would wait to publish a study until days before the voter registration deadline, wait a year, they have let the voters down in those states. It's really disappointing because it's possible they got some of the names wrong and it's possible there might have been problems. The time to identify that was in 2019 after they had been released publicly. So we can get those voters back on the list. That's the most important thing.
When I said voter suppression, I don't think I meant only list maintenance, but I was thinking of things like closing of precincts and, you know, one drop box per county and voter ID requirements and lots of things that seem to me designed to reduce the number of people voting more for political reasons than for voting accuracy or against fraud.
I think this is why it's so important to use the term voter suppression sparingly. There are incidents that really do appear to be voter suppression. I think what Governor Abbott is doing in Texas right now, limiting each county to a single drop box, regardless of whether it has some 700 people or it's one of the five largest counties in the country, as Harris County, Texas is. That kind of thing is absolutely, it is not going too far to call it voter suppression. It is changing the rules in the middle of the game. The counties were ready to provide more options for voters. There's no legitimate integrity reason to limit the number of drop boxes. And I think that's why I push back so hard on the idea of calling everything voter suppression, because I think it almost lets real voter suppression off the hook. When you see something like what we're seeing in Texas, we're seeing particularly restrictive voter ID laws, which do occur. If we see unusual application of things like witness requirements on absentee ballots that are waived for voters who are older, I mean, these are the kinds of things that should give us pause, and we should really investigate, are these Are these being done for political purposes to reduce the number of voters that one party thinks is going to vote against them?
What did you think about that ruling that you wouldn't count an absentee ballot if it wasn't in a security envelope?
Well, so that was done under state law. I think you're referring to the Pennsylvania decision, the so-called naked ballots decision. We probably need to take a much closer look at a lot of our laws, some of which put administrative barriers in front of voters. And the intent is not necessarily to suppress the vote, but there's no real good reason for it. And most election officials will tell you in Pennsylvania that the secrecy ballot doesn't really serve much of a purpose anymore, particularly given the huge increase in mail voting that's supposed to occur. However, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did analyze that under the express language in the statute and came to their conclusion that it was still required. So, I mean, that's probably a red flag for the legislature that they should be looking at the statute to try to better serve the needs of Pennsylvania voters. All that said, I don't think the legislature is going to do that. The legislature has been unwilling to do some other very reasonable reforms in Pennsylvania, such as allowing them to begin pre-processing mail and absentee ballots before Election Day, which is a very good practice done in both red states and blue states and helps them get election results out faster and helps them secure the integrity of the vote because they're confirming people's votes and whether they voted well in advance. And Pennsylvania doesn't have that ability because the legislature was unwilling to act. And so we might get much later results out of Pennsylvania than we would out of some of the other states.
I mean, I'm with you that this is a terrible area to politicize. It seems like it can be super damaging. How do you suggest activists who feel like they've identified a wrong being done ought to work on it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of key points, and I really thank you for that question because I think it's a good one. One, there's a period of time before an election that if you implement even good changes close to an election, it will have a negative effect. That negative effect will be paid in voter confusion and other problems, and perhaps lower turnout. And we are well past that point right now. So if you're releasing a study, even if it's the methodology is sound, that says a voter purge occurred and it's days before the voter registration deadline, if you're suggesting changes in election law 4 weeks before a major election, you failed. You've just waited too long. And so in general, you know, it's not sexy, but a lot of media want to talk to me right now. Next February, no one's going to want to talk to me. And that's the most important period of time. State legislatures will be in session. Odd numbered years are when voter list maintenance and other laws are occurring. That's the time to present documentary evidence of what you think should be done and how improvements can be made. And then that brings me to my second point, which is if we start every conversation by pointing at the other party and saying, I don't trust you, you're a crook, you're a criminal, and you're suppressing the vote, or you're encouraging voter fraud, which is what happens in these discussions so often, we are going to get nowhere. And that is where we find ourselves right now. The fact is there are some consensus solutions. Eric is a great example of those, that if you start the conversation from a different place and build relationships and build cross-partisan agreement, you can actually get someplace. There are things like pre-processing of ballots. There's things like no excuse mail voting, where there is pretty significant consensus. And if we can take it out of an election context where right now everyone's trying to figure out which rule is going to help their candidate win, but we can do this in an odd numbered year when state legislators are considering options that don't necessarily have an impact on the next election, we might have a chance of doing something. And so I think turning the temperature down and turning the light up is always a good idea. And that's what hopefully we'll see a little more of, although I'm somewhat skeptical of that.
It sounds to me like that time at Pew must have been pretty rewarding. And certainly, I mean, as many people as I've talked to have worked on getting more people registered, it sounds like what you were doing there kind of dwarfed some of the other efforts out there. Why did you leave, and what was the impetus for starting your own thing?
I think that's true. I think if you look at the number of people that have been registered just as a result of Eric, it's probably in the eight figures now. And there are not many voter registration efforts that have yielded that kind of impact. And that doesn't even count the 8 figures of people who have had their record updated. They had an out-of-date record, and they're now getting correct information about elections. And I'm very, very proud that I was able to play a part in that. In the summer of 2016, honestly, Pew came to me and basically told me they were going to get out of the elections work. And I wasn't done with my work yet. So I left. It was a classic example of bad timing on the part of Pew, because this work was about to get as important as it ever has been. I and another colleague left Pew and founded CEIR, and I've been continuing this work ever since. And initially, we focused a lot on the election security issues, the cybersecurity issues, because those were kind of first and foremost in the aftermath of the 2016 election. And we've worked on things like cybersecurity of voter databases, et cetera. But with the onset of the pandemic, we've also been working very, very heavily on kind of adaptations that need to be made, providing resources to election officials to allow for them to offer safe and convenient voting to everybody, even in the midst of a pandemic.
Why do you think Pew got out of the elections work?
Couldn't tell you. No idea.
How has it been putting together your own operation? Tell me about like the steps. I know it's, I think of that as political entrepreneurship. You've got to create something out of whole cloth. You got to raise money. You got to put a board together. What was it like?
You use the word entrepreneurship, and that's exactly right. I know a lot of people who very proudly consider themselves entrepreneurs, and rightfully so, and I've always been impressed with entrepreneurship. I am not an entrepreneur. I have never thought of myself as an entrepreneur. I probably
would be
someone who, yeah, I am now by accident, but you know, I probably would have been very happy to just collect a decent enough paycheck as a lawyer at the Justice Department for almost my entire life. That's basically what my grandfather did, working as an antitrust lawyer for the Department of Justice back in the middle part of the 20th century. I probably would have been completely content at that. It was a great job and most of the time. And I found myself after Pew was getting out of this and an election was upon us. And I talked to a lot of my colleagues and friends who work in this space, including election officials, who wanted me to stay in the space and wanted thought the work needed to be done. So in very short order, you know, we registered as a C3, incorporated, got a board of people who knew this space well and could help and advise, and started the business of fundraising, which I had done at Pew to some degree. And fundraising for a C3, if you know people who lead C3s out there, it's challenging. It's just like running a small business. You need to get out there and raise money so that you can let your staff know that they're going to have jobs long term and you're able to do the kind of work that is important. We're now over 4 years along now, and we've been very fortunate. We're now fairly well established, got a staff of about 8. And some contractors as well, and have built, I think, a fairly good reputation across the political spectrum, work very closely with Democrats, work very closely with Republicans. I feel very, very lucky to be doing the work that I'm doing that I still love.
Where did you find funding?
So mostly initially from established foundations, places like the Democracy Fund and Hewlett Foundation and Ford Foundation and the Joyce Foundation and others. There, we've been very fortunate to receive some gifts from individuals. The McKinsey, formerly Bezos, announced that we were a recipient of a grant from her earlier this summer. And it was a very generous grant. We're very grateful to her and others as well. And, you know, we're a fairly small operation. You know, I don't ever anticipate my organization will become, you know, 50 employees in multiple cities. I think we've always kind of strived to be lean and mean and punch above our weight. And so I think we're a very good value for funders, and they've seen that and fortunately have invested in us.
You said you got going with election security, cybersecurity on voter databases and stuff like that. What needed to be done? What did you do?
The conversation, as is so often the case in the realm of election reform, often devolves to the political very quickly. The people who were upset after the 2016 election were people who opposed President Trump, and the people who were happy were the people who supported him. So the people who won the last election want minimal change. The people who lost the last election want to burn the house down and get a whole new system in place. And that has been the dynamic all the time. But there was a new wrinkle here in that foreign actors, specifically Russia, had definitely interfered. What that created, though, was a challenge because people who opposed President Trump often saw Russian influence and delegitimization of elections everywhere, even if it wasn't there. And some wouldn't even accept the results of the election as legitimate. And that's really damaging. Either party, if they start questioning that results were legitimate without evidence, without really good evidence, that's damaging to the long-term health of our democracy. The 2016 election was analyzed more than any election in American history. There were 75% of the ballots that were cast were paper ballots, including all of the ballots cast in Michigan and Wisconsin. Those ballots were analyzed by independent researchers to confirm the results. The fact is, there is still not a shred of evidence that suggests anything other than the fact that Donald Trump won a majority of votes, barely, in states that comprise a majority of the Electoral College. That's all. I know that upsets a lot of people. I'm not going to talk about my own political preferences, but that doesn't mean that we should delegitimize elections overall. And so trying to find the real vulnerabilities, such as in voter databases, because voter databases were accessed by agents of the GRU, Illinois was in 2016, but contextualize other vulnerabilities as either legitimate or very, very unlikely. That was really where we were working. And it was really important to identify the areas we need to work on and improve real vulnerabilities, while at the same time working to boost voter confidence in other ways.
Do you think we're ready for 2020?
I think we're as ready as we can be, especially with cybersecurity. There is never a finish line. You never cross the finish line and say you're totally secure. Anytime technology is in play, there's no such thing as an entirely secure technological system. Anytime humans are in play, there's no such thing as a 100% entirely secure system. But I can tell you this, the 2020 election is going to be the most secure election we've ever held. We had 75% auditable paper ballots in 2016. That number is going to be closer to 95% in 2020. There are entire states that had no paper ballots in 2016. Georgia is a good example. A lot of Pennsylvania had no paper ballots. A lot of Virginia had no paper ballots in 2016. Those states are now all paper ballots. There are going to be audits of those paper ballots in a large number of states, the most ever, including states like Michigan and Georgia, which are performing their first statewide audit. There's information sharing between the federal government, the state governments, and the local election offices in a way that literally did not exist in 2016. The organization that through which they're sharing information called the EIISAC, didn't exist until a couple of years ago. That's all being done now. And so we're much better off, we're much better prepared than ever before, which does not mean we're invulnerable. It's going to be exceedingly difficult to mount an attack on the votes. And it's almost certain it will be detected.
The president has suggested that mail-in ballots are essentially a security risk, that people could forge them or vote more than once that way. Is there anything to what he's saying?
Short answer is no. All voting in the United States is incredibly secure, whether it's by mail or in person. There's been a lot of research and investigation done about voter fraud over the last 20 years. The Bush DOJ spent millions of dollars over years to find voter fraud. President Trump himself, through his Election Integrity Commission, tried to find evidence of voter fraud. Republican and Democratic secretaries of state do investigations after every election. What they have found is that voter fraud is not non-existent, but it is barely existent. There are very, very few cases, literally dozens of cases out of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of ballots cast. So the system works. It has many checks and balances in place. And in addition, there's both a healthy respect for democracy amongst Americans and also a lot of deterrence, because voter fraud is not the crime of the century. You're basically risking many years in jail and many thousands of dollars of fines to cast one additional ballot in an election in which 150 million ballots are going to be cast. This is not smart. So it's not done, and you're almost certain to be caught. There's just reams of documentary evidence on each potentially fraudulent ballot. And I can tell you this as a former federal prosecutor. It just rarely, rarely happens, and that's really good. Mail ballots have a lot of checks and balances in place. And in fact, the president obviously votes that way. Members of the White House vote that way. And just yesterday, he tweeted out that voters in Arizona should vote their mail ballots. So there's obviously some kind of schizophrenia going on there, because the Republican Party, as well as the Democratic Party, have been encouraging their voters to vote by mail for decades. And that makes a ton of sense for them, because those ballots are secure, but they're also cast early. And every ballot of one of their supporters that votes early is a voter they don't have to turn out later. So the campaigns love mail voting. And I think that's caused some consternation probably in the Republican Party to see the president delegitimizing it as much as he's trying to do.
You said Russia had interfered. What did they do?
There was a two-pronged attack. One was they attacked some election infrastructure. It was mostly just scans, but they sent some spear phishing emails to election officials and vendors, hoping someone would click on it. And they did actually get into the Illinois voter registration database in June and July of 2016, although it was confirmed they deleted and changed nothing. What ended up happening in Illinois was they got into the Illinois voter database. They didn't do much. They weren't even accessing many records, and they went unnoticed for about 2 weeks. And then in the middle of July, they all of a sudden started accessing a massive amount of records, just all of a sudden. Like, they turned the volume all the way up to 11 suddenly, and it was instantly detected. In fact, there's been testimony there was no way they couldn't detect it. It basically shut down their systems, and they then shut everything down. They disconnected everything, and they made sure no one could get access to it. I've had discussions with people about why the Russians did that. Why, if they were undetected in there, why would they do that? And the answer is pretty obvious. They wanted to be detected. They wanted Americans to think that their structure, their election infrastructure, was insecure and they couldn't trust it, because that would lead to further delegitimization, which led to the big second prong, which is the much greater prong, which is disinformation. Get voters to doubt their own system, voters in a democracy to doubt elections and even democracy as a system of government. And on that, they've been enormously successful.
Ugh. You said that you had kind of moved with the pandemic to other adaptations in voting. Tell me a little about what you're up to there with your center.
Yeah, so we're working really closely with election officials to assist them, particularly with voter education right now. And that has to do with the pandemic, but also with the proximity of the election. Right now, the single most important thing right now is for voters to feel like they can navigate the system, they know how to vote confidently and safely, and that their ballot's going to count. And all of the big policy discussions, all of the pointing of fingers and everything else that we can do that later. Right now, the most important thing is that every single eligible American voter is able to cast a ballot that will count, and they feel comfortable doing so, and they have the information they need to make the choices that they're going to need to make about whether to vote by mail or vote early in person or when to return their mail ballot, et cetera. So we've been working with election officials around the country on this. My organization, Center for Election Innovation Research, received a very large grant recently from Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan to re-grant money out to states to assist them with voter education. We've made those grants out. 23 states are receiving grants to assist them, sending mailers to states with information about how to navigate the process, do paid media. And these states, by the way, are almost evenly distributed between Republican and Democratic election officials. This is really a nonpartisan effort. It's just good for voters to understand how to navigate the process. And that's particularly true, not just because of the pandemic, but because a presidential election is an election in which the largest number of infrequent voters participate. It's where we see the highest turnout. We're going to see tens of millions of voters who at most vote once every 4 years, if they vote at all. And to give them information necessary to navigate the system, to do things that they might not have done before, vote returning a mail ballot, asking for a mail ballot, going and voting early in person, volunteering to be a poll worker, because we need so many new poll workers. Hopefully, we're going to be able to assist a lot of states in being able to provide that information to their voters.
I recently talked to a professor at Amherst called Lawrence Douglas, who has a book about whether Trump will go, and it lays out some scenarios for catastrophes that would end up in sort of disputed slates of electors. and, you know, just a mess after the election. There's a lot of different ways we could imagine a mess. And it seems like this work on election legitimacy that's core to what you're doing is going to be so crucial in a close election, particularly with an incumbent president that seems predisposed to yell about it. How do you see the post-election time for what you do if it is close? I mean, it may well not be, but if it is close and things get really, really contested.
Well, I think, first of all, the best protection against any kind of chaos, any kind of vacuum that's created where we're not sure of the result, is overwhelming turnout. And right now, I cannot stress this enough. All of our messages, all of our discussions with the media, with voters, have to be designed to encourage them to vote. Everyone should vote and everyone should know how to vote. The best chance we have of avoiding the kind of nightmare scenarios that some have posited is to have overwhelming turnout that could lead to larger margins. So that's incredibly important.
But one just question quickly on the logic of that. I mean, if the overwhelming turnout results in super close, as it might, how is that any better than less turnout and super close?
It's very unlikely that overwhelming turnout will lead to super close. We can't control how people are going to vote. We don't want to control how people are going to vote. But what I can tell you is overwhelming turnout's our best bet. If this country is truly 50-50, if we had 100% turnout and the candidate you don't like wins a narrow victory, and you think that's a loss, then you probably shouldn't live in a democracy. We need to have a system in which we are comfortable with the idea that we may be on the losing side, but we also need to have a system where we're comfortable in the idea that everyone should get their voice heard. And I'm just telling you, there is absolutely no doubt about this. Fiona Hill wrote a really great piece in the New York Times that I encourage everyone to read. The best protection against chaos, against disinformation, is voting. There are two reasons for that. One, it's likely to create larger margins. But two, every vote is a data point. Every time someone votes, it's a data point that tells us whether or not something in the system isn't working. So for instance, if someone has changed voter registration data, making it difficult for some to vote, the more people who vote, the more likely we're going to discover it early and be able to fix it. If someone gets in and changes whether people have received mail ballots or not, the more people who vote and the more people who return their ballots earlier, the sooner we're going to discover it and be able to fix it. So it's super important that all of our messaging be designed around encouraging people to vote early, and have confidence in the process. If we get to the days after the election and the election is very close, the candidate that thinks they are losing is likely to do everything they can to delegitimize the process. And watch for that. As a consumer of media, be very, very sensitive to that and realize the candidate who thinks they're winning is the one that says, let the pre-approved process continue. And you'll know who thinks he's a loser and who thinks he's a winner. And then the process has to continue. Election night is not a thing. It does not exist. It is a fiction we have created. There will be more ballots left to count in California than the next 20 states combined on election night. But we'll be confident in the outcome of California because the margin's expected to be large. So in states that don't have the benefit of a large margin where it's going to be close, that process is going to have to appropriately continue. And we're going to have to be really careful. And I'm working on this with many to support that process, support election officials of both parties who are going to need to make sure that they are given time and space to transparently process all of the remaining ballots, to validate them appropriately, and to count them through that process where election certification eventually happens in the weeks following the election. And that's going to be really hard for us because we all want to know who won. But it's a message we're having to spread over and over and over again, which is patience. There's a chance we know who wins on election night, but there's also a chance that we might not know for several days later.
You mentioned that fewer people are going to be talking to you in February than are talking to you right now. What should we be doing in February? What should they be asking you about? What reforms should be put in place after we get through this?
I mean, the first things we should be doing when elections are not upon us, we don't think about the rules. And of course, that's the time when we have to be thinking about the rules, because it's when both sides are so far away from the next election that the dynamics of that election aren't yet set. So they haven't done the calculus over what thing is going to help them and what thing is going to hurt them. So, for instance, if we had been talking about no excuse absentee voting, no excuse mail voting before, as some states did, by the way, Michigan, Pennsylvania, those things were passed in 2018 and 2019 before the pandemic and before the political dynamic was set. We didn't even know who the Democratic nominee was going to be then. If we tried to pass something like that in either one of those states in August of 2020, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's really important, I think, in 2021 to look at the data. We're going to have really good data after this election about who voted, where there were problems. And then I think we focus first on consensus areas. Where can we expand voter choice while maintaining integrity? Where can we do things like no excuse mail voting? Where can we do things like expanding the amount of time to process ballots? Where can we do things like reducing unnecessary witness or notary requirements on mail ballots? Where can we make early voting work better for voters? You know, we've often talked about expanding just the number of days. Ohio has 28 days of early voting. That's probably unnecessary. We could probably do a lot better by having 10 to 14 days of early voting, but expanding the number of sites and hours. So having those kinds of conversations where there is consensus, where there's goodwill on both sides to discuss things, I think that can go a long way. The right has gone too far many times with excessive voter ID laws, which are unnecessary and don't lead to integrity. But, you know, there's been efforts to push universal mail voting on states that probably aren't ready for it. And that's a hard, you know, the states that do it well have been doing it for decades and evolved over that time where their voters were educated over and over and over about it. And I think we have to have some hard conversations and even look ourselves in the mirror a little bit about are these changes really in the best interest of the voter as opposed to, you know, my pet advocacy agenda.
It is such a pleasure for me to talk to someone who's so steeped in a subject and knows it so well. It's really an honor. Is there a question that I failed to ask that you wish you could answer?
That's very nice of you to say, first of all, Nathaniel. Thank you. It's not really a question, but I would just ask all voters, everyone listening to this podcast and everyone else, to just be really skeptical consumers of information. We all find ourselves siloed in media bubbles where we very understandably want to hear only from those who agree with us and who give us information that confirm our existing biases. If we think Donald Trump is an illegitimate president, we'll listen to people on Twitter and Facebook who confirm that for us. If we think Donald Trump is being attacked by the hard radical left, we'll listen to media that confirm that for us. We should be most skeptical of those media sources that confirm our biases, that tell us that which we want to hear. And we should actively seek out reasonable media. I mean, I'm not suggesting turning on OANN or something, but, you know, we should actively seek out reasonable media that might challenge us. And I think a great example of this is, you know, I'll often see in my media feeds when a Republican voter against Trump or, you know, a principled conservative says something bad about the Trump administration, I'll often see some folks, not many, but will say like, oh, yeah, well, where were you when XYZ happened, you know, when Iraq happened or when it. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's really not constructive. There's an opportunity here to build consensus and you don't have to love everything someone has done to agree with them and work constructively with them on an issue. And Russia and others actively are working against this. They want us to be divided. They want us to leave a vacuum on the international stage that they can fill. And they've been incredibly successful in that. It's almost a patriotic duty to support integrity of elections, to find ways to challenge your views, at least to educate yourself and maybe find opportunities to reach consensus with someone you might not agree with often. And then lastly, of course, and most importantly, vote. I mean, vote early. Do it today, whenever you're listening to this. If you haven't returned your mail ballot, find a drop box or an election office and hand it in. Go vote early in person. Do it as early as you possibly can.
All good admonitions, I think. I really appreciate your time today. Anything else you want to say?
No, that's it. Thanks. It was great talking with you.
Good talking to you, too.
That was David Becker. David is at electioninnovation.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.